Welcome to ITE 1 Module 16, Advanced Security. Regrettably, Geraldine is indisposed today, and she's not with us. She will be back next week, we hope. And that would all be good. Okay. I'm just looking up why my Braille display is showing me the wrong things. Okay, this chapter reviews the types of attacks that Grade 2 translator, please. Thank you. Okay, I don't usually use the Braille display on this one. That threaten, that is far better. Right, I'm just going to JAWS this and do it because my Braille is misbehaving, or I might open this in Notepad because Note Tab's getting in my way.
Kind of love the Braille display.
Yeah, I'm going to have to barely, because I haven't actually seen the notes for this before, but that's all right. Okay, risks from computers come from both internal and external sources. Well, funny that. The internal sources are inside your organisation and the external ones are outside. We make this stuff really complex, okay? Internal being employees that want to rip off your money and steal all your stuff and embezzle your goods and you fired them so they got upset. And that's all good. And then external ones are people hacking in from outside. The FBI, who apparently make up 62.5% of their statistics, say that 70% of attacks are actually internal attacks and 30% are external. No, it's not in the notes. It's in Discovery. After completing the chapter, you'll be able to do all sorts of things. Outline security requirements based on customer needs. Select security components based on customer needs. Have you noticed that customer needs comes in here a lot? Okay, so you've really got to check with the customer. Implement customer security plan. Perform preventative maintenance on security. And troubleshoot security. Okay. You outline customer security components. You select security components. Implement security plan. Perform preventative maintenance. Troubleshoot security. Did I just do those twice? I have no idea. An organization should try... I'm going to have to fix this view up on Note Tab because I've got too much crud on the Braille display. Talk amongst yourselves. Grace, how are you enjoying your new MSI Wind? Thank you. You've got about a minute to fill.
I'm just installing JAWS on the thing so I can start trying to set up Ventrilo on it so I can run it on the house while I'm in lecture. And it's going to be really cool when I get it to work. So, yeah, it's rebooting now. I'm just waiting for the lovely JAWS installer to come back up. It's all really exciting. But, yeah, Carrie kind of decided that to convince me to get one of these Winds, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll get one. And it's navy blue, and it's sweet.
JAWS has made changes that have probably hosed your computer. Press Enter to complete hosing your computer, or Escape if you think you can possibly cancel. No, that's not true. Does anybody remember when...
And if you think you can cancel, you're totally wrong.
Yeah, does anybody remember when Dr. JAWS used to do a number on your video card settings, and it would do some...
Dr. JAWS.
We've all heard the Patrick Perdue parodies.
Yes, that was awesome. Yes. I was 13 when I heard it, and I thought it was the greatest thing.
Absolutely. There's a whole stack of them up on my server. I've got the whole archive of stuff.
Patrick ones?
Yeah, and all the singing deck talk stuff, even the stuff that Graham Pierce did.
They're funny, aren't they?
They are indeed. Okay, I've actually got my Note Tab behaving itself now. No, I haven't. Why, when I arrow down, does it show me the wrong thing? It says convert text to HTML. No, I don't want that. Talk amongst yourselves.
Well, he's not the only one having issues. My JAWS hasn't yet come back up. I'm wondering what's going on.
No, you'll have to relaunch the installer by hand. It doesn't always relaunch it when you log back in.
Oh, good. I just ran it.
Especially if you're bringing it from a network drive or something.
Try from the internet. That was really stupid of me.
That's why you should have installed NVDA first, because it works. Oh, I've been at grace about NVDA for days. The voice is horrible, but it gets you out of so many scrapes. It's the best bit of kit.
It's really good, isn't it?
I know. I've discovered that. I played with it today, but just on that computer.
The thing I like about the NVDA is the installer is lightweight, and it plays that wonderful song that Victor Seren wrote, and it installs itself, and you've got something that is far better than Narrator to actually get yourself out of the nasty stuff.
System access to go is going to have to do.
Yeah, that'll do. Okie dokie. Now I'm just going to have to do this with Jaws because my Braille display is still showing me the wrong things. And I don't know why, so we're just getting on with
it. Did you restart?
Shouldn't need to restart. It's a USB device.
Did you restart Jaws?
You don't need to. It just picks it up. It's one of their blessed Braille displays that the drivers actually just pick it up. Oh, I can certainly do that. There we go, Jaws is gone. Okay.
I find that when Jaws screws up and restarting it usually helps, even if it's not something you'd think Jaws is responsible for.
No, Jaws is responsible for everything. Okay. No, it's still showing the wrong thing, so I don't know why that is. It doesn't know where the cursor is. Okay. An organization should strive to afford the most affordable security protection against data loss or software. Now, that's obvious, because otherwise you are in trouble and people are going to rip off with your stuff and you're going to go bankrupt. Okay. Technicians and the organization's management should work together. Okay? They should work together, not at odds. They should not have fights in the coffee room about whether we're implementing this or that, and management shouldn't go out on a sulk strike when we block access to Facebook. Okay. So you've got to make sure that you have your equipment protected against security policy, and you basically document all the stuff you're protecting against, otherwise you have no idea what you're protecting against. Okay, you might be doing this, otherwise we wouldn't be doing this chapter. Is the computer located at a home or a business? Home computers are more vulnerable to wireless intrusion than business computers. I think that's rubbish. I think any computer is vulnerable to a wireless intrusion, especially given the number of people who walk around with cell phones with wireless capability in their pocket. So I disagree with that statement entirely, but that's all right. Business computers have a higher threat of network intrusion. Yeah, I'd probably go with that. And users can abuse their access privileges, which is rule one of administration. Don't give users access to anything more than they need. Because if you give users access to more than they need, they squawk when you take their access away. So don't give it to them in the first place. Is there full-time internet access? One would hope so, but maybe there isn't at your organisation. In fact, at the tax office, we don't have full-time internet access. The more time a computer is exposed to the internet, obviously the higher the risk of virus infection. Funny that, but then again, if you plug your mate's flash drive in, that can also fill your computer up with viruses if your mate wasn't particularly good with the old antivirus or weren't keeping their definitions up to date. I was actually speaking to somebody in the cafe the other day. I do that from time to time. When I'm not eating, that's right. And she basically was saying, I bought this copy of Office and then it wanted to download stuff off the internet, so I told it not to, because I shouldn't have to. And I said, well, yes, you should, and those are very important security fixes and service packs, and if you've paid $400 for this copy of Office, you might as well download the updates for it, because otherwise you're not going to be protected against the nasty things that the service packs fixed up. Okay, is the computer a laptop? Is it a desktop? Physical security is an issue with laptops. This is very true. I don't know whether anybody's noticed, but on the... usually somewhere on your laptop there is a little oval-shaped connector, and in fact Jenny's Eep has one in case she wants to look for it, and it's called a Kensington lock slot. And what you do is you put this little lock thing in it, and then you turn the key and it spins this little bar so that it's facing 90 degrees from the lock, and it locks into the laptop, and then you attach the other end of the cable to something that isn't going to move. And that locks your laptop from being lifted up and stolen. And in fact, there is actually an interesting case recently where somebody actually did steal the laptop Just lifted it up and took it off the desk and just walked out with it. So that's your is that working? No, it's not. The audio. Yeah, just okay. Sorry, I wasn't sure whether it had clicked in or clicked out. Oh, good. Okay, just having a panic. Okay, we're going to be able to outline a local security policy, explain when and how to use security hardware, how about when you've got it and whenever you can, and explain when and how to use security application software. Okay. You want to outline the security requirements of the customer based on their needs. How important is security to the customer? Now, the interesting thing is here that you usually rate security in a monetary value. How much is it going to cost your business if you are offline? How long can you afford to be offline? And is that going to cut into your bottom line? This is important. So when you're trying to justify your security policy to management, you say, I'm going to need a copy of Sophos antivirus, and this is going to be $40 per PC, and they go, well, we don't have that in our budget. And you go, well, do you have $4,000 in your budget for downtime? You'll suddenly find that the amount of money you need for the antivirus software will suddenly come out of the accounting coffers. The other thing, of course, important is backups. I don't think we really talk about backups in this course. In fact, how many people don't know how to back up their Windows XP machine? Quite a number of them. Very disturbing. And it's not something that they teach you, and it's something we're all expected to know, and nobody ever tells you. So we might actually do a Thursday chat on that, I think. That'd be a lot of fun. Okay, a security policy is a set of rules, guidelines, and checklists. I'm going to have to put notepad back here because this is really annoying me. I want this braille. Ah. Oh, yes, there we go. Is it going to work? No, it's working. Okie dokie. Okay. Yay, I've got braille. Okay, defines an acceptable computer issued statement for an organization. Except my grade 2 translator got turned off, but we can fix that. There we go. And for an organization, it makes the braille a lot shorter. Identifies the people permitted to use the computer equipment in an organization. Which devices can go onto a network? Also things like modems and wireless access points. What are you going to do to make sure your data remains confidential? No, you cannot take your work files home on the flash drive. And in fact, there are actually workplaces where you've got security people that will actually frisk you for flash drives and stuff before you leave the building to make sure you don't take stuff home. Determine a process that will allow the employees to obtain access to the equipment. Interestingly enough, all of the students here, I believe, had to sign an acceptable use policy before they could get access to the computers. Yes, if you haven't signed it, you are breaching the policy and we get to take you out and string you from something. Right, 'cause very important. It's all about lawyers and liability and nasty things like that. But basically, we have to have these policies so that if you infect our network with a virus by plugging in your flash drive, we hunt you down and have a very serious talking to you and clean up your flash drive. And there are also consequences if for your failure to comply. Okay, so pretty heavy stuff. And some of those consequences can cost you your job, and that's not very cool. Okay.
Just a comment. Even school students now who use computer labs have to sign contract thingies.
That's exactly right, because you've got so many students that tend to know the computers better than the instructors, and they tend to be causing merry hell on the computers and stuff. That's not very cool, because some overworked, underpaid technician has to run around fixing up all the mess from such and such who installed the Terminator Judgment Day screensaver, which just happens to interfere with Microsoft Access. This is an interesting point, actually. A lot of people don't think. And when they're not thinking, they go, I want the cats jump through the hoop screensaver. So they get their friend to email it to them in a zip file that's been encrypted, and they sneak it through the mail filter, and then they install it on the computer. And little do they know that the cat that jumps through the hoop screensaver has some bizarre interaction with Microsoft Access that causes all of the databases to crash whenever they're launched on that computer. And it might happen to corrupt the network copy of the database as well. And then they're a bit confused when you come to them, absolutely seething with rage, to inform them that if that cat that jumps through the hoops screensaver does not get uninstalled from their computer, they will be uninstalled from the office. So you cannot foresee the impact of a piece of software that you are going to bring into an organization, what effect it is going to have on the running systems. So when I tell NADA that I'm bringing something in to install on the network, I always suffix it with the phrase, and I will deal with any that might happen as a result of me installing that application, so that I am then responsible for the havoc that I may wreak on the network. And I fully stand by that. We had a case a couple of years back where, and this is sort of diverging from the notes a bit, but it's very important if you're working as a technician that you practice personal responsibility for your actions. You have to be responsible for the repair work that you undertake, and you take on the responsibility of the repair work. And a couple of stories here. The first one is we went over to a friend's place, and I don't know whether Elise is still on. Are you still on, Elise, or not?
Yep, I'm still here, yep.
Well, we were over at somebody's place in Queensland, my boy, and we were fixing up his internet, and he was absolutely terrified that we were going to break it. Absolutely terrified. And I turned to him and I said, you know what? If I break this, I will extend my plane ticket and I will stay here until it is fixed. And he sort of said, oh, well, I really can't do much better than that, can I? I said, no, you can't. I said, I want to make these changes to your networks. I stand behind those changes, and I will do whatever is necessary, up to and including buying you a brand new computer, to make that all happen. And, of course, I didn't need a new computer.
Very generous.
I knew that.
But it just meant you stood by what you meant. Yeah, you were confident, and you proved to him that you were confident and able to do the job.
That's exactly right, and that's important. Now, I mean, that's assuming that you can actually do the job and that you're not just putting it on. Now, if you're putting it on, you're in a lot of trouble. So, did Mukesh make it in here? Yeah, I think he did. Ah, good. Good morning, Mukesh. I don't have my chat window open. Ooh, I'm naughty. Okay, so you're practicing personal responsibility for the work you undertake, and you are making sure that you don't cash checks that your tail can't cash, as one of those cartoon characters once said. I can't remember who it was, I'd have to look up the quote. It's very important that when you're working on computers that you take personal responsibility for the work you do, and you know what you're doing, and you have a plan, and you know how you're going to fix things. Yes, mistakes do happen. Yes, you do end up trashing all of the data on somebody's computer at least once in your technician career. And the fact is that, generally speaking, people are relatively understanding if they can see that you have done the best job you possibly could have. So say, for example, I was working on one of the EPCs and I made a mistake that took out the entire contents of the hard drive. Obviously the user would be very upset, but it had better have been an honest mistake and not just me messing around in RegEdit because I thought I knew what I was doing. So personal responsibility is very important, and it all goes along with the whole integrity, personal integrity, and how you deal with these sorts of things when you are working on a computer job and stuff. How would you feel if somebody did the exact same things to you that you did to them in an irresponsible manner? You'd be pretty hopping mad. And that's fine. I mean, everybody is human and we all have our limitations, but you've got to take your work very, very seriously. And there are times when it will all go pear-shaped and it will all mess up and you will have to pull out of a job. But you'd better make sure you've got a watertight alibi and be able to explain your reasons and things, because otherwise things are going to go very bad for you. Okay. The things you need to have in your security plan. The steps you take after a breach in security. Who to contact in an emergency. Turn on active follows. Thank you. Who to contact in an emergency. I just said that. That's okay. I can say it again. information that you should share with customers, vendors, and the media. Yes, that's important. What are you going to tell them? And how much are you going to tell them? And how much do they actually need to know? Secondary locations to use in an evacuation. And what services are you going to restore in what order? Now, one of the single most important tasks you can get over and above customer communication, of course, because that's number one. Okay, number one is customer communication. Number two is prioritization and time management of events. And here comes Grace on from the MSI Wind, if we're lucky. So you need to make sure that you can prioritize your jobs and get the essential services back online straight away. Another story here, because I'm a storyteller when I tell lectures. I once went to fix up an ISP in Lismore that was in incredibly bad shape. And I went in there and we basically had to rebuild both of the ISP servers from scratch. And the guy sort of said, look, whatever he needs, whatever he wants, as many whoppers as he can eat, we need this service up and running, you know, so that we can continue our business. And we understand if there'll be some downtime. And we went into the office and Todd said, well, I'll turn this computer off and I'll turn that computer off. I said, no, you won't. I said, first of all, we will rebuild the new machine and we will build the new machine up. And once the new machine is up and all the databases have been transferred across, we will do a cutover onto the new machine. Oh, well, shouldn't I shut? No, don't shut anything down until we have the new systems working. Right, now do the cutover. And I think it was the Monday morning, the boss came back and said, do you guys do any work this weekend? I said, yes. And he said, well, I didn't notice anything. I didn't notice anything go wrong. I mean, what have you done? I said, well, we've rebuilt the entire server. And he said, well, did you take anything offline? I said, yes, we had a half an hour downtime at 4:30 on Saturday afternoon. He's like, oh, half an hour? That's nothing. I said, yeah, that's the idea. And in fact, the customers thought it was just a blip in service and they had no idea that we'd rejigged all the service, redone all the mail service, switched over to a completely different database system and brought the whole lot back online. And that's the way you're supposed to do things. It says that a security policy must be enforced and followed by all employees. That's also pretty important. And there's a worksheet. So we're all going to see copies of that worksheet come from you all. Eventually, yes. Okie dokie. Just going to read down a bit here. Oh, mate, we've got terrorist attacks leading to theft of network equipment. So it looks like Ahmed will be certainly wandering into the building. And you wouldn't understand that unless you were here watching the ventriloquist video that Alex had on his machine earlier. Okay, explaining when and how to use security hardware. There should be hardware that prevents theft, data loss, and something else. And data loss, there we go. Okay, so we've got backup. We've got things that are locked down, nailed down, tied down, chained down. And I'm talking about office equipment here, just so that we're all clear. And then you've got things that are physically secure, so locked in cupboards and things. And there's one of those quizzes where they say, where do you have a file server? Yes, do you have it sitting out on the desk like we do here? No, you don't. You're not supposed to. Okay. Basically, we just smack students when they walk too close to the file server. But obviously, some physical security would be good. And it would be nice to have the file servers locked away somewhere safe where they won't be messed with. Okay, fences, they're always useful. They stop people from getting in. And security hardware, such as alarm systems and key fobs and all of that sort of funky stuff. There is an alarm system in this building, and if you get into this building somehow and stuff, you will trip the sensors and the alarms will go off and the nasty men that will remove you from the building will turn up from the security firm. Not something you really want to be doing. Okay, protect the network infrastructure such as... I might as well just read this off the braille. Cabling, telecommunications equipment, and network devices. And it says scroll down symbol. Okay, list of four items. Secured telecommunications room, lock it all up. Wireless detection for unauthorized access points. Yes, how many people bring their laptop in, set the button that lets you turn it into a wireless access point? Yes, this is one of the features of your MSI WindGrace. You can turn it into a wireless access point. So you can hook it into the Ethernet, turn it into a wireless access point, and then have everybody else connecting through your MSI Wind. How cool is that? Hardware firewalls. And network systems that detect wiring and changes in patch panels. Here's where we advertise Cisco. Cisco has a wide range of switches with an incredible degree of security features that allow MAC address locking, port lockdown, and other advanced security features to prevent people from doing stuff they shouldn't. There are other vendors that have those sorts of features too, but Cisco switches, especially in the high end, have the ability to do all sorts of cool things. Individual computers. Cable locks, which I talked about, which are the... And we've got one in the storeroom, so we can show you one later. You can actually see a real one. Yes. Laptop docking station locks, they're always useful. Lockable cases. And secure cages surrounding desktop cases. I mean, that's a bit extreme, but sometimes you need to do that. Now... No, I meant to ask, has Grace managed to migrate over to the web yet, or is she not online? Ah, she's not on. She must be having a problem. Okay. Maybe her internet fell over or something. Okay. It's a moment. Okay. We're looking at things like lockable HD carriers. Maximize that window so it stops making. Secure storage and transport of backup media. That's probably pretty important. There's no point backing all your stuff up onto a stack of backup tapes if some swine is going to nick them on the way to the secure storage facility. Also, keeping the backup tapes on the kitchen table at home is not going to be cool, especially if one of your competition walks in and swipes off with the backup tapes. So that's pretty important. USB security dongles, they're kind of cool. And in fact, there's a little thing you can get for your EEP or your laptop, and this is kind of funky. Basically, you have a little battery-powered transmitter that sits on your keychain, and you have another thing that plugs into your USB port. And if you are within 10 meters of the laptop with your keychain, you have access to it. But if you walk away or somebody disconnects the USB, it locks the laptop. I think so. Yeah. Yes. So it means that if you walk away from your laptop and see if it's sitting on the desk, the software will lock it up solid until you walk back into range. And some of it will either unlock when you come back into range, or you actually have to provide a password to unlock it. And I think those kits are about $40. They're actually quite cheap. So yeah, interesting. Okay, the right security mix. How will the equipment be used? That's important. What sort of people are using it? There's no point putting in incredibly complex security if you've got a stack of business. I'm sorry, I'm keeping you awake. Yes, and I'm still going to keep you awake. Where is the computer equipment located? Jenny's having a yawn here. And what user access to data is required? So obviously a computer in a public library, you're going to want to stick it in one of those cages and really lock it down and stuff and increase the security, because you will have people trying to vandalise things, and that's not particularly cool. Also in call centres, servers will probably want to be in locked equipment rooms because you don't want people messing with them. If you're going to use a laptop in a public place, the security dongle is something that you might want to look into, and I can probably best might guess my bottom dollar that I'm going to be asked to find some after lecture, so I will post my findings to the Cavi Discuss list when I find some security dongles. Yes. Okay, security applications protect the operating system and data on the computer. These are the sort of products you can get. Software firewall filters incoming data, and yes, it is built into Windows XP. It does not, however, prevent outgoing connections. It does to a degree. The new firewall in SP2 and higher does prevent outgoing connections. But one of the problems with configuring firewalls is that if you have too many alert boxes and stuff pop up, users are going to get really cranky and they're just going to go, why does it keep asking me? And one of the things that can happen is it can come up with things like CQ32.exe is trying to access the internet on port UDP 21804. Yeah, your average user is not going to know what that means. And that's going to result in one of two things. They're either going to click always allow, or they're going to pester the IT support staff with questions. Okie dokie. Intrusion detection systems, they're things that watch out for attacks on your network, and they monitor changes and stuff into your network. Applications and update patches, which repair various security weaknesses. Now, just out of morbid curiosity, which computer did you end up with? Are we on the wind, or are we having a problem with that, and we'll sort that after lecture?
We're on the wind.
Yay, there you are.
Just was wrestling with the configurations, so yay!
Did you turn back on? There is. The answer, my friend, is running on the wind. No. There is, my friend, the wind. Yeah, Dennis Roussos. I've got it in my MP3 collection. Along with some panpipe music, but that's okay. I meant to ask, was it? Now, did you end up using the actual configuration utility that came with the wireless card, Grace, or did you end up switching it over to the Windows one?
It came with the Windows one.
Okay, I'll ask you which wireless card you've got later, because it's not important to our lecture at the moment, but there's three different ones you can have in your wind. Okay, there are several software things that are allowed to protect your computer against access by malicious code, which is nasty programs. Virus protection. Yes, things like malware and spyware. And there's actually a program called Spyware Bytes, which is a pretty funny pun. Malware Bytes, I think it's called. Is it Malware Bytes? It's not bad, apparently. Don't know how accessible it is, but people tell me it's not bad. Spyware protection. As for spyware, we recommend AVG-free for virus protection and SpyBot Search and Destroy for spyware protection. We do not recommend Spyware Doctor because it slows your machine down. But if you insist on running it, then so be it. And when weird things go wrong, the first thing we're going to do is uninstall Spyware Doctor. That's just us. Adware protection, which SpyBot Search and Destroy also does. And greyware protection, which is that funky software that pretends to be useful, but it's not really. Now, obviously, if you use any of the spyware that, or protection and virus protection that I just recommended, and your machine gets hosed, we take absolutely no responsibility, neither express or implies to the limit or fitness for a particular purpose of any of the information that we've just provided. In no event shall we be liable for any damages, either indirect, consequential, incidental, or coincidental, from your use of any of the information that we have provided. Okay, now that's enough of a disclaimer. We will only be liable for the cost of the advice that we have provided you, which is free. So there you go. Right. In small offices and homes, computers generally connect directly to the internet. No, not usually. You've usually got a four-port router with a network address translator in it, but when these notes were written, you probably did have single-port USB modems or two-wire gateways that only had one port. This puts computers at higher risk if they connect directly to the internet. So you have to be aware of that. You should have an antivirus program and you should have a firewall. If your computer connects directly to the internet without going through a network address translator, you should have antivirus and firewall on your computer, or it's going to last about 2 minutes. You should have all of your software and stuff up to date with all of the latest patches and stuff. I would actually be a bit careful about that, because if you install every update as soon as Automatic Update offers it to you, you can often get some quite nasty grief on your computer, and I would strongly suggest that people subscribe to Windows Secrets, www.windowssecrets.com. I think it's about $5 a year or something. You donate what you feel the publication is worth, and you get a paid newsletter every month that has some very useful information in it about which updates are hot and which updates are not, and they'll tell you which ones to install and which ones not to install. And I really find that it's a very excellent presentation. There's a thing called Patch Watch, which is written by a woman called Susan Bradley, and she tells you which updates you should go away and install straight away and which ones you should possibly hold off until Microsoft fixes them up. Okay, obviously the more you do for security quality, each step costs money. Unless, of course, you're running Linux, and then I suppose the money is actually in the time of the people setting it up rather than the actual software, generally speaking. So, as I said, you should calculate the costs of data lost as a trade-off against the security policy and make sure that one doesn't cost more than the other. Has anybody got any questions so far? It's the sound of silence. Will this lecture
end? No, no question.
And Jenny's gone to sleep again. No, she hasn't. Ow! Ow! Rive's in pain. Okay. Well, I thought I'd better have some DVS there. You know, Carrie writhes in pain, crumpling to the floor. And then you sort of hear me going, argh, in the background. Okay. Software firewalls, intrusion detection systems, applications and OS patches. Well, we've been through all that. Select security components based on the customer needs. And basically you figure out what the customer needs and you get it for them. And you should probably discuss security issues with the customer if they don't have a security policy. We had an interesting situations a few weeks ago. Apparently Chris was doing some work for a real estate agent and they had hooked two wireless routers together. And two DHCP servers were running on the network, and whenever the routers got turned off and turned back on, the PCs would allocate different IP addresses in different orders, and the technician was charging them $100 every time they power cycled their routers to come out and fix it. Wow. Mmm, dodgy deals.
Nasty.
Use your past experience as a technician. If you don't have any, get some. And research the stuff on the market if you're going to be a technician. Or even if you're going to be a savvy home user. Have a little idea as to what's going on if you possibly can. And the goal is to provide the security system that best matches the customer needs. What if I can talk any faster? I can actually, but I will not. Okay. After completing the session, you'll be able to complete these objectives. Okay. Describe and compare the security techniques. Describe and compare access control devices. So what's the difference between a firewall? What's the difference between antivirus? What's the difference between an intrusion detection system? And describe and compare firewall types. Okay. You might want to use more than one technique. Passwords. The things we love to hate. Your password should be 20 to 26 characters long, contain letters, numbers, uppercase and lowercase, special symbols, and things you've only ever seen in Egyptian hieroglyphs and must be changed every 3 days. Are you going to be popular? I don't think so. Your password will be system generated and looks like vaguely comprehensible modem line noise. You should remember it, and if you write it down anywhere, you'll be in trouble. No, that's still not going to make you very popular. However, you should possibly set your passwords to things that people aren't going to guess. So the name of your dog, Trevor, is not cool. Unless you are never going to mention your dog. Okay? Just as an example. And Trevor's not here to defend himself, so we'll be moving right along. Yeah, you will. So you need some passwords that are not going to be easily guessable. I do not have all of my passwords set to Gemma123 or I love Gemma. Your three most common passwords are love, sex, and secret. No rock and roll, no. That's probably number four. Would love to... Oh, yeah, here we go. That's an interesting quirk in JAWS. If you're looking at the Braille... Oh, no, that's because it's got expand current word turned on. I was trying to figure out why it had U-S-I-N-G rather than the contraction. Yeah, okay, that's expand current word. I'm with it now. Okay, people can actually run software on their network that can actually sniff off plain text passwords and stuff, and there are things such as Telnet and POP3 that by default use plain text passwords, and often, for example, on things like university networks and stuff, there are all sorts of students running packet sniffers. So you want port-based security on your switches, you don't want traffic travelling over links that it shouldn't travel over, and you don't want them sniffing off passwords and things.
Clarification?
Yeah?
Sniffing off passwords means actually being able to access people's passwords, is that right? Is that
what you mean? Yeah, the term sniffing refers to the practice of actually watching network traffic and actually looking at what network traffic is travelling, which is why we call it sniffing, and you grab the packets off the network wire and you look at the passwords as they come in, and it's called sniffing because it's a bit like, I don't know, it's a bit like a dog sniffing at something and having a look at it or something.
Got it.
Alrighty. Event logging should be enabled and auditing, although don't log too much because you'll never look through the logs. Make sure you are sensible about what you are going to log and what you are not going to log. Network access by unauthorized users. Yeah, obviously you don't want that. Wireless is especially vulnerable to security intrusions. Yes, we know, they keep telling us, although people still insist on leaving their access points unsecured. If you leave your access point in unsecure, bad things, TM, will happen to you. If you've only got a 300 meg internet quota, you're going to find that the neighbor's kids are going to rip off with all your quota, and you could end up with quite a nasty internet bill. In Australia, for example, on the I'm a person who doesn't use a lot of internet and I only want to spend $19.95 a month on my internet, you get 100 meg of traffic. Extra megabytes are charged at 35 cents a megabyte. Yes, that's $3.50 for 10 meg. So if your neighbours are going to pull down a couple of gig, you're going to end up with a nasty bill. So be aware of these things. If possible, get a plan that actually shapes your usage rather than one that charges you per extra megabyte in case you do go sailing over your bandwidth cap. Encryption technologies are used for encoding data on the network, and various encryption technologies are used for various data encoding. Hashing is a process where you actually look through a message and generate a secure one-way calculation on the data, and it's used for checking out whether data has been corrupted or not. A hash is considered more secure than a cyclic redundancy checksum. And examples of hashes are MD4, MD5, and SHA-1. And we don't really talk much about those, but it's apparently a number that's calculated when you look across the file. And you can go on Wikipedia up MD5 if you're really that interested. Hashing uses a mathematical function, and it uses a numerical value that is unique to the data. That is not quite true. Somebody has managed to actually crack MD5, but it's not an easy thing to do. Just because you know the message digest does not allow you to recreate the message, because the message digest is usually only 128 or 256 bytes long. Symmetric encryption is where you both have the same key and you both know what that key is going to be. The problem with symmetric encryption is that you need to be able to communicate the password over a secure channel before the encrypted communication takes place. So if I walk into the cafe and go, "The password on the network machine is wibble wibble," that's obviously not a secure channel, and my symmetric encryption isn't going to be any good. Then if I write the passcode on a piece of paper and hand it to Jenny and she can't read it and she gives it to somebody else to read, that's no good either. So, bit of common sense. How would we communicate the password? Symmetric, you must use identical keys to encrypt and decrypt the data. So the password is love, sex, or secret, and then you encrypt the data and send it through. Obviously don't use the previous three passwords. Okay. Asymmetric encryption. This is pretty cool stuff. It uses two keys. It uses a public key and a private key. And how it actually works, and this isn't in your notes, is that basically you find a very large number and you find the two prime factors that are going to multiply together to give you that big large number. And one of them is the public key and one of them is the private key. When I say big number, I mean numbers that are 1024 bits long, so they're actually quite big numbers. So factorizing a prime is obviously very important for encryption. The public key is used to encrypt a message for somebody who is going to receive it, and then they decrypt it with their private key. And if they sign the message with their private key, you can actually check the validity of the signature with their public key. So one key checks the validity of the other. Kind of cool. Only private key needs to be kept secret, and public keys can be shared around. Can anybody give me an example of where public key encryption is used on the internet just about every day?
Banking? Get into banking stuff?
Yep. I'm looking for the funky name for the technology. Anybody know what the technology is that does this?
SSL certificates.
Yes, SSL or TLS, which is Transport Layer Security and Secure Socket Layer. Anybody ever wondered how the security model in SSL actually works? Probably not. Okay.
I had to install one the other day, so it was all interesting.
Now, interestingly enough, did you buy one, or did you actually go to CA Cert and get them for free?
We bought one. I didn't know you could get them for free, but the customer paid anyway, so I wasn't out of pocket.
Okay, now one of the interesting things about SSL is that how it actually works is you have what we call a whole set of root certificates. And these are trusted certificates that are issued by the signing authorities such as Verizon, Thought, Microsoft, etc. And your browser is preloaded with a series of root certificates. And that's how it actually gathers whether the encryption keys are trusted. Now, one of the things you should be aware of is sometimes root certificates are compromised, and there is actually some cases where there is a certificate revocation list. And when you have a certificate revocation list, you end up with a case where you actually have to invalidate one of your root certificates. So when you're going through Windows Update, you probably want to install the root certificates update. And I'd recommend that people go through Windows Update and they actually install those updated root certificates. Otherwise, you could be open to some vulnerabilities. Now, there is a place where you can get SSL certificates for free. It's called cacert.org. The root certificate is loaded by default into Firefox, but it is not loaded by default into Internet Explorer, at least in versions up to version 7. So it does mean that people who are initially visiting your site may need to actually load in the cacert root certificate, which is why most people don't bother and they go and pay somebody $100 a year to have security that just works straight out of the box. There's nothing wrong with cacert.org, it's just that the root certificate is not generally bundled with Internet Explorer, or at least it wasn't. So I don't know whether it is yet or not. It is bundled with Firefox, though. Okay.
I decided it wasn't it.
We decided it was what, sorry?
I thought we had decided that it was in 8.0, or Internet Explorer 8, and it did show up in it.
No. I haven't been to CA Cert with IE 8.
No, I thought I'd been to some website that did it and didn't give me a certificate invalid error, so I don't know.
We can certainly try that. I actually do have a CA Cert account, and I can generate certificates and stuff, so we'll certainly have a look at that. All right, for a cyber lollipop, can you tell me, Grace, what is a VPN?
Virtual Private Network.
That's an acronym expansion. Yep, what's it do?
It lets you, it acts like you're actually on someone's network when you're actually really not there. So you can get like email and you can go see their computers without actually really physically being on their network.
Okay, that is true. A virtual private network is a network that carries secured data across the internet, and it does make you look as though you're on the other person's network, and it actually uses encryption and verification to make sure that the data is protected from snooping by people who are on the internet and outside the actual network. So it's carrying private data over the public internet. And yes, that's how Grace checks her email on my servers. She uses a virtual private network called OpenVPN, which is free, www.openvpn.net, and it runs under Windows and Linux and OS X. So there you go. It also runs on Linux.
And it's cool.
As if you, it's very cool. Okie-do. And the points that you connect with this software are called secure tunnels, because you are tunneling secure data over the internet. Okay, I'm just going to read down a little bit more notes, because it's talking about how cache encoding works, and you can read that in your notes, or you can Wikipedia up MD5. How come you dropped off earlier, Grace? What happened? Did your wireless chuck a skitsy, or did something go wrong?
A reboot is required to finish installing this AVG.
Yes, which means it's managed to lock down the... Did you uninstall the Norton Internet Security that comes on those things, or actually don't those things come with an antivirus?
That'll be next.
Ooh, nasty. Never ever have two antivirus things active on your computer. Bad things, TM, happen, but you should be able to get yourself out of it.
I should be okay. It's only going to be on there for about 5 more minutes.
What we actually have found is that you should get away with that combination, but we've actually found that if you've got two antivirus software copy on the same computer, they actually fight with each other. And then if you're really unlucky, they latch the system up solid. Okay, now, we're now talking about the various methods of security, and you're talking about two-factor security. So what you might have is you might have a swipe card and you might have a PIN. And you might have to swipe your card and put in your PIN, which is what you have to do at an ATM. That is what we call two-factor security, because there are two things that you have to do to allow yourself to access that stuff. And they're saying, again, you've got to consider the cost of the system against the value of the equipment. It is really quiet on lecture today. I wonder what happened to everyone.
I finished paying my bills. I'm paying attention to you now.
Oh, you don't have to pay attention. You've already completed this this topic.
I know. It's just nice to listen in and hear it all again sometimes.
This is true. And if ever you have that yearning to hear it all again, you'll be able to download the recordings off the website and fill up your MP3 player with our lectures. Okay. And if you're Jenny, you have your finger hovering over that bookmark button so that when I say the magic words, "This is in your exam," she's belted that bookmark button twice and her little stream's gone, "Insert bookmark. Bookmark 47 inserted."
I was going to wonder when the Victor stream came up, because last year it was the Euro Labs. This year it's the Victor stream for me.
Yeah, they're pretty cool, aren't they?
I don't think any vision.
I love mine.
With that one.
Welcome to Victor Reader Stream. Yeah, it's like, hurry up. You know, welcome, I want to read all my Reader voice samples. Yes, that's right.
Oh, just for information, no, there was no other antivirus on there.
Ah, good. I haven't re-ghosted my Win from a bear install for quite a while. And no, a bear install isn't something that's going to bite your arm off. I'm just talking about when you re-ghost from the recovery media. Okay, a lock. I'm just ignoring that remark. It's a common security device that stops you from getting into things, and if you lose a key or the key gets stolen, you've got to replace all of the keys and probably the lock. Not very cool. A conduit, which is a casing that protects the infrastructure from damage. Yes, we should be putting our cables in conduits rather than running them under the floor mat. Okay, I've seen this done. People run their cable, "I'll be right, I'll run it under the floor mat." And then they wonder why, after person 400 has tramped across this mat, why all of the pairs are split and broken and stuff. Card keys, you can. They're basically things that you swipe, a bit like the pass I've got around my neck, which luckily has a release thing so that if somebody pulls on, it'll actually come off my neck rather than finishing me off. And, yeah, I know, you'll have to think of something else. And if you lose the card key, you can actually disable a specific card key and issue another one. More expensive than security locks, in a way. Video equipment, and you need to make sure that your video equipment is going to work and it's going to record things. And then, of course, if you're at the Christmas party, you can obviously record all sorts of interesting stuff with the security equipment, and then we don't condone that sort of behaviour. Okay, because we can't see it, that's right, it's no fun for us. A security guard, they control access to the premises and they wander up and down, and sometimes they've got a nasty dog that will bite you, as opposed to Peter's dog, which just sort of munches on you. They do. Okay, all cables should be inside conduits or mounted in walls. I think it's pretty obvious. Network outlets that are not in use should be disabled. Yes, we don't want people coming in with a laptop and going, boonk, and then connecting onto the network, which you can actually do around here, but that's okay because we tend to supervise things fairly well. You're also looking at biometric devices, which measure things like your fingerprints and retinal scans and stuff. In fact, fingerprint sensors, there was something on, what's that thing called? Where they debunk things. Thank you. There was a thing on Mythbusters. I don't like Mythbusters because they don't always look into things as thoroughly as they possibly should. Couple of things that spring to mind. One of them is they tried a whole stack of fingerprint sensors and they managed to fool a lot of them, although I think the technology has improved since that one went to air. And the other thing they did was they said they reckon it's a myth that if you spin a CD up to 52x and the CD explodes, it will ruin your drive. They couldn't get their CDs to explode. All I can say is you haven't been and bought cheap CDs from the Melbourne swap meet. I have actually seen a CD explode, and it totals your drive. It literally smashes holes through the front of your CD-ROM drive. And little shards of mylar are just scattered everywhere. So don't buy cheap CD blanks. If they are $10 for a spindle of 100, don't. It's not worth it.
Well, yes.
I got them for $14, and they're fine. And then 2 days later, I wouldn't buy those $14 ones. All of the covering is peeling off them. And this is not a surprise.
No, and that's why when you go over to his place, you see all around his coffee table in the lounge room stacks of cheap CD blanks that will probably never ever get used.
That's right.
Hey, it's a disposable coaster.
Yeah, that's exactly what he does use them for.
Pretty much. And he'll be using them as that until end of time. There's so many of them there. You should see this coffee table. It's like an island in the lounge room with so much junk around it. It's incredible.
The interesting thing is I actually have a CD as my coffee coaster, and I've actually blue-tacked a failed burnt CD onto my table, and my coffee sits on top of the CD. And it's actually quite good because you can actually wipe down the smooth surface with a cloth and clean up all the little coffee sloppages that you sometimes get being blind and drinking hot drinks, and you get a nice clean coaster again. So I'd strongly recommend them as coasters, and they're actually bigger than your average coaster. And you actually sort of, if you really want one that's going to be in a permanent location, you get a little bit of blue tack on each corner and just on each side of it and blue tack the thing down. That's good. Stops them sliding around too.
I've seen people use them as tying them up when they're growing grass and got seedlings in their gardens to keep scare the birds off.
Yeah, you can hang them in the tree, and you can also use them for making a shiny mobile to keep your infant amused.
I've never seen one with corners, though.
No.
That's what you said, though.
What did I say?
You take a beach corner.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. What I meant, I was on two edges. On two edges. So we're just seeing if Jenny was awake there. And I was actually doing a little intelligence test to see if you guys could find the corners. You could also argue that the curve is an infinite corner. So, yeah, you know. Yeah. You can protect data's by two-factor. We've been through this. I'm not talking about that again. I will stop repeating myself. Okay. A smart card. They have a chip in them, and they store data securely. Well, that's the plan. And in fact, those smart riders that you get, and you go past the machine, and they go, I can't do the noise. There we go. That swipes you on and swipes you off, and it tracks how much money you've used up and all that sort of stuff, unless you're one of us and you have a travel pass, and you go for free. Insert maniacal laugh. And they connect to a reader, and it scans the information on the smart card. There are also some, for example, the one that opens the front door where you just have proximity of about 2 or 3 inches, or 6 or 9 centimetres away from the reader, and it also beeps and lets you in.
Question, a little bit off topic, but those little security chips you get in your credit cards, how do they work?
They are actually some of the machines actually do have a chip reader in them, and when you slide the card into the machine, some contacts come into contact with the chip that's embedded in your credit card, and it reads off the unique ID off the chip. Now, one of the reasons they did that was because in the old days, back when I was young, and you would go to an establishment that was perhaps a little suspect. And the first thing they would do would be scam your credit card by taking a photocopy of each side. And in fact, some of the more advanced organizations would actually, and in fact, this happens quite a lot. There are teenagers with camera phones that basically grab your credit card and go, psst, and take a snapshot of both sides of it. So they then have your credit card number, your name, your expiration date, and your card verification value. So the chip is meant to circumvent that sort of attack, because unless you get a verification on the chip, it won't actually allow people to use the card. Security fob, and they are a small device on your keyring that has a little radio transmitter, and they're sort of a bit like the things where you sort of press it on your car and it goes tuff, tuff, and your car opens up, except for when the batteries go flat and you don't have any batteries and your car doesn't open up, and then you call the RAC to bust in for you. The RAC is our local rescue city drivers who never prepare themselves for potential emergencies organisation. Okay, don't get me started on whether people should be prepared for little emergencies and whether they should know how to check their oil and water and stuff, because that would be a lecture in its own right. But I do, actually. Yes. I do know how to check the oil and the radiators, because I lived in the country. But no, in the city we all just pile money into the RAC so that you can just call somebody up and then complain about how long it took for the person to get to you so that they can check your problem. Biometric device, we've talked about those, let's move on. So things like fingerprints and eyeball retinal scanners. Of course, on every bad science fiction movie, there's somebody who's modified the biometric sensor to turn the laser up to incredibly high wattage, and you can burn people's eyes out with them. That usually doesn't happen with regular security devices, but on sci-fi movies, you'd be surprised.
Be interesting with a retinal scan for people who don't have any eyeballs.
Yes, or people
who don't
have
any retina. Yeah, that's what I was wondering about.
They have to come up with an alternative method, and that's usually fingerprints. And if you don't have any retinas and fingers, then maybe we're not going to let you in. We're going to complete the security device matching thing in figure 2, so we'll just scroll past that. Anybody got any questions so far? Okay, hardware and software firewalls. Hardware firewalls are firewalls that look like a device. They usually have one or more network interfaces, and you often configure them either with a web interface or a command line interface, such as the Cisco PIX firewalls, which are a Cisco product and are very expensive.
Is one better than the other? Is there any particular reason for using one rather than the other?
It depends on who you talk to and who's selling you your stuff and what the technicians you're working with, what they feel is good or not. Most home routers do include a firewall of dubious usefulness. Now, the reason I say that is if it is correctly configured, it is excellent. If it is not correctly configured, it can be the source of all sorts of nightmares, like MSN not signing in, Skype not working, your inability to connect your email. Funnily enough, if the default policy is deny and you put your firewall on, you won't get any traffic to the internet whatsoever. So it helps to understand how these things sort of work, and most people don't. So you either need a knowledgeable user or you need to read the book. Who does that? In fact, you should all read the documentation to the best of your ability. And I get some people that go, I don't learn very well from reading the documentation. Can you show me? Sure. But then when I go away and 6 months later and you want to find out how it works, may I suggest you read the documentation? So it's very important that people get used to reading documentation, and it is an acquired skill. If you never do it, you'll never get any good at it. If you don't want to read the documentation, at least be familiar with the help files. And anybody who doesn't know Windows Help by this point in the course, I would strongly recommend you learn about what F6 does and how to navigate the Windows Help things, and we can go through that a bit later. But it's something you should certainly be able to do. Because most programs have help in them, and it helps to be able to read the help. And we're going to sing any Beatles songs.
Is, like, reading manuals and stuff, are they getting more accessible for us? What you find a lot these days is when you look through manuals, you've got half a dozen different models in the same manual, and it's very hard to tell what you're reading.
This is true, and that is usually the fault of the document writers, and there are certainly bad manuals, but there are also certainly good manuals, and sometimes the product that you buy, pardon me, should actually be bought on the quality of its manual, if you can actually find out whether the manuals are any good or not. There are software such as Nuance PDF Converter, which can convert most PDFs into accessible format, and it actually includes OCR software in it. I think the software is around about $69 Australian, but it's actually not bad, and it's far cheaper than QuartzFile 1000, which also will convert PDFs out for you, but is far more expensive.
And Nuance also thing is brilliant.
It is. Also, apparently, the new version of PDF to TXT from Jamal Mizrui on the empowermentzone.com also has optical character recognition in it, which I think is www.theempowermentzone.com/p2setup.exe. And that's in one of our Thursday chats. So we'll have to go and have a look at that, because apparently it's pretty funky.
Does Nuance read secured PDF documents?
If you know the password. And that's the key. If you've bought a PDF and you know the password and you can feed it in, yes, it will quite happily pull it out and drag it out for you.
Half the time the people who sell these things to you don't even know the passwords. That's what I've found.
They should if... Well, usually the password's your email address or something. Have you had a problem where you've actually got secure documents and they haven't known what the password was?
Yeah, my teacher actually did that. He's like, I don't know what the password is. I have no idea. So he had to, like, get me the actual text files he really encoded or whatever.
Yeah, that's not very cool. Now, we're talking about the things in firewalls. A packet filter is a set of rules that accept or deny packets. Funny that. And packets are obviously things that work at the network layer of the OSI reference model, because frames work at the data link layer. We don't even do that in ITE, but that's good. A proxy is a firewall that actually accepts or denies traffic based on certain rules, and you can actually set the rules that it lets things through, and the proxy actually goes and gets the thing for you. So we have a web proxy on our network, and the reason we have a web proxy on our network is because it caches all of the things that come down, and basically what happens is if one person fetches all of the Windows updates, when the next person goes to fetch them, they come straight out of proxy. Very handy thing to have on your network. And I actually recommend that people build themselves a little Linux box, or have somebody build them a little Linux box to act as a proxy, which usually costs about $200 or $300, and it makes all the websites load faster, and it all does all sorts of nice things, and you hook it up to your network, and it goes like a mad thing. But each to their own. Stateful packet inspection is something that keeps track of connections that are open and closed in and out of a network, and it allows stuff through for open connections, and it doesn't allow stuff through for closed connections. That's why it's called stateful packet inspection, often abbreviated SPI. So when you're reading a router spec and it says this Fugle 176 router contains SPI and NAT, natural firewall, you'll know what they're on about, kind of, or at least you'll have seen the term. We've talked about hardware firewalls. This is a long chapter. Okay, now a hardware firewall is a freestanding unit. It's often installed on routers and things, or you can actually get a hardware firewall, and it does not use the resources of the computer that is protecting. That is one of the disadvantages of software firewalls, is that they do take up memory and disk space and stuff on the computer you're running, and if you hammer them with packets from the outside, they can actually slow your computer down somewhat. And into the Tic Tacs she goes, I think. Ah, drugs, okay. Okay, we have a worksheet, so we... Let's go past that. Okay. Okay, two of the most common security problems are... Levels of permissions for folders and files, so understand how NTFS partitions work, permissions work, and how share permissions work, especially if you're going to do network administration stuff, and also understand how the encryption and stuff on your wireless access point works, and what encryption you have enabled, or make sure your kids understand it for you. Both FAT and NTFS allow folder level permissions and file sharing, although there is a difference between file permissions and share permissions, which we don't go into. Under Windows XP Home, you cannot set file system level permissions. You can on all of the versions of Vista. So we're talking about WEP, which is Wireless Encryption Protocol 64.0.128, or you've got the non-standard 256-bit enhancements to WEP. You've got WPA, which is Wi-Fi Protected Access, and you've got WPA2, which is a second revision of that standard. Unless you have a particular reason or devices that will not support it, you should be using WPA2. We have some PDAs that will only do WEP, so we use WEP. MAC address filtering is where you say which specific computers are allowed onto the wireless access point, and that stops other computers from fortuitously associating with your wireless access point. You can turn off the SSID broadcasting, and that will stop your wireless access points from broadcasting their SSID. However, if any wireless station communicates with the wireless access point and you have a copy of Kismet running within wireless range, it will decloak the hidden network. So it's one of the security methods you should use in combination with the other two. Alrighty, anybody got any questions so far?
Not so far.
Do people want to stop at this point? We could come back next week.
I have a question that slightly might be of interest to some people, and but not particularly to do with IT. Well, it is to do with IT, actually. It's not to do with the actual course.
You can ask that if you wish. I think we're going to stop there, actually, because it is 10:30, and we've actually been through a lot of material today.
I just thought about buying one of those, what do you call them, KPM switches, so you can have the monitor, keyboard and mouse, one set of that across two computers and switch them. Do you know whether there are any good, particular good ones to buy, et cetera, what I should be paying, you know, without using brand names and doing any advertising?
KVM, which is a keyboard video mouse switch. There are three types. Essentially, there's one that handles the old PS2 connections, which gives you two or four switches for keyboard and mouse, and they do the RGB monitor connections. The other one uses USB, and you have ones that have USB and monitor and video and the mouse. And the problem with those is they often have the ability to switch the sound card input from one computer to another, but they've got these resistors to actually connect the sound in line with the actual sound card, so actually switching the sound from one computer to the other sounds like absolute crud in a tin, basically. So we don't use the audio switching capabilities on ours. And the other thing you're going to find is that if you buy a DVI keyboard switch that has all the DVI on it, it's going to be $100 more expensive than anything else. So be warned, it ain't cheap. Usually the keyboard and video monitor switches are good. Make sure they have sufficient cables to serve your needs. Make sure they have sufficient ports to serve your needs. And make sure that the cables are long enough to reach the computers that you're going to switch between.
Yep, fair enough. Any idea what I should be paying? I don't think I'll bother with one with DVI or any of that on it. I just want one that just does mainly the keyboard and mouse, to be honest.
Probably about... depending if you're going for sort of a two-port model, you can look at about 40, 50.
That's all right. I might even drop down. I might get one from the swap meet, but I'm probably do better just as well off going down to a local retailer and picking one up this afternoon.
Yeah, it's up to you. The swap meet ones are good, aren't too bad. It depends on what sort of way you switch between the computers. If you've got a two-port KVM, often switching between the computers you do by double-tapping the scroll lock key, and that will switch you from one computer to the other. If you've got a four-port one, then obviously you double-tap the scroll lock and then you tap the number from 1 to 4 to pick which computer you actually want to flick across to. It's also worth noticing that you cannot switch from one computer to another unless one computer is powered up to provide power to the KVM switch.
One computer always will be, because one will probably be my server.
Yeah, I just thought it's worth mentioning because some people want to know why they can't switch to the other ports when there's actually all the computers are shut down.
Well, how would you know that you're not switching if neither of them are functioning? So you actually have to have at least one going or one in particular going on one port?
At least one going.
Yeah, that's sweet.
And you can tell which one you're switched to if you've got something powered up by looking at which light has lit up. Obviously, for vision impaired people, you just want to switch to a particular computer and you'd know that one was actually going to switch in. I think we've got an A10 one on our table and it's got four computer inputs. It's got a USB, one USB connector, because it actually makes the keyboard and mouse show up on a little USB hub, so you only need one USB port on the back of your computer to connect both your USB keyboard and mouse. It has a VGA connector, and then it has an audio connector that we don't use. And they're actually quite a nice unit.
Yeah, well, I was thinking I can then put 5-volt back up, because I'm a bit limited for desk space, which is why it doesn't get hooked up so readily.
If you've got multiple computers and you want to save on desk space, a KVM is definitely a good thing to buy, and they're often used in server rooms and stuff where you don't want to have 6 keyboards.
Well, this is just it. I mean, so 5-volt won't get as much use as it never, you know, as it always did, and you know, Challenge is always going, and you generally SSH into that, but it's nice to have the keyboard and mouse on it. So I thought I might just use that desk for both computers and have my normal workstation over this side of the room.
Alrighty. Well, I think that's about us done for the day. So if anybody's got any questions, otherwise I think we're done for the moment. And just for reference, we're up to section 16.3.1, configuring firewall types.